There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, our daily podcast that brings together the very best bits of today's show from Monday, January the 13th.
But what will you be paid in 2020? That's a question we've been looking to answer. Do love a salary survey.
And this is a good one, to be honest. There's lots in it. It's from the guys at Nadia, one of the most established recruitment companies here in the Middle East. And it says a bunch of stuff. First up, the death of the expat package. Well, that is going to continue in 2020. They say that those packages where you got paid and then you got your rent. And then you got the school fees, and then you got your car allowance, maybe even a beach club membership. That is...
Who are these people?
Well, I've never had one of those, but they are increasingly rare. That's one of the key findings. The other finding that we noticed was that salaries didn't increase much last year, and they're probably not going to increase much this year either. So let's get more on this now from one of the authors. Ian Giulianotti is executive director of Nadia Global, the parent company. And we began by asking him, first of all, about the expat package and its continued demise.
Traditionally in the UAE, we've had expat packages, which were based for people that were on a short-term overseas assignment for a major or an international company. And that's carried on over the years. Now the market has changed because we have a lot more, rather than expats, what I call impats, i.e. people coming to the UAE seeking jobs. And their expectations are X amount per month. And that X amount per month is a round figure number. They find their own houses, they drive their own cars, they pay for the kids' own education. There's none of these extra allowances that we used to have, so it's an all-in package.
Now, that might be true for middle management and below, one of our listeners has pointed out this morning. The people, you know, the likes of us, maybe, but for executives, well... There's a theory that those in the top suites are still getting all the perks. And we said to Ian, is that true?
Obviously, to attract talent, companies have to pay. And they have to pay a market rate. Now, if you take the fact that the majority of companies will specify in their contracts a housing allowance and a transport allowance, yes, that is there for senior management. But it's more and more for them. It's moving more and more to bonuses.
Right. So we're looking this year at 1.75 to 2% pay rises, apparently, on basic salary as well. So it's not even like it's in your take-home pay. And we said to Ian, what sectors will be most in demand? If it's all about market rate, if it's all about getting the top talent in, what sectors do you want to be in?
Wherever there's a shortage, then you will see pay rises to match the market. Yeah, in order to attract people. So technology at the moment, VAR, Internet of Things, artificial intelligence, there is a shortage. It's a new technology. There's a shortage of people around. So you have to pay a premium.
And we've been looking at VR this morning as well. 42,000 jobs, PwC reckons, will be created. More on that to come. But we did wade into the weeds on this one. We got into that tricky territory that you worry discussing off script that you're just going to say the wrong thing.
This is the issue of people getting different salaries for the same job, depending on their nationality or passport. And we asked Ian what's happening in this regard.
There always will be discrepancies. There always will be. But the gap is growing smaller and smaller as each year goes on. But it's more towards the, shall I say, non-third world nationals are getting less rather than third world nationals are getting more.
That is Ian Giulianotti of Nadia Global, the recruitment company. Right, we've also been talking virtual reality. It's going to be big, the experts tell us. PwC, new report, reckoning that there's going to be new jobs, 40-odd thousand of them in 10 years. And quite a big chunk of cash coming from this section into the country's economy, into the GDP. Our producer, Mohammed Suleiman, has more.
$15 billion. According to a new report by PwC, that's how much virtual reality and augmented reality are forecast to contribute to the UAE's economy by 2030. They say it'll boost the country's GDP by 1% in the next decade. The report also found that VR and AR will have a significant impact on employment in the Emirates, adding more than 40,000 jobs to the market. Globally, the two streams of technology are expected to add $1.5 trillion to the global economy by 2030. Experts at PwC say that virtual reality and augmented reality will also have a significant impact on the workplace in the next 10 years. They say it'll open up new ways to improve the efficiency, productivity, and accuracy of employees and the tasks we carry out. Currently, fewer than a million jobs across various sectors are impacted by VR and AR, but this will rise to 23 million by 2030. This is Mohammed Suleiman reporting for the Business Breakfast.
And we've had one of those experts and indeed the report author in the studio with us this morning, Stephen Anderson, Clients and Markets Leader for PwC Middle East. And we said to Stephen, all right then, 42,000 jobs, where do you see them coming from?
So the jobs both creating and in terms of enhancing those roles, and there's probably four areas, I'll go through them quickly, that we see the biggest impact. There are lots of impacts across different areas. One is in healthcare. We're seeing AR and VR being used extensively in healthcare, particularly on the training side of things where you, so for example, we on surgeries, it's much safer to do that within a VR and with the rise in haptic technology, which means you can add both the real world and VR together, means you can really practice and practice makes perfect, and getting things wrong, obviously, in a surgery environment is very difficult. So therefore, you're seeing big advances there. We're also seeing in healthcare rehabilitation. So you'll see that the ministry, MOHAP, recently has launched a VR rehabilitation centre for things like recovering from strokes, physiotherapy, where you can start to get that movement again from a VR perspective. Secondly, in education. So we see huge advances in training and education. Just to add some examples, maybe three quick examples. One would be on things like diversity training. So we just launched something on unconscious bias. So if you get yourself into a VR world, interview someone, think about how you select a team, and you can practice in that environment and actually learn quite a lot in a VR world. We're all seeing things like cyber attacks. So how do we recreate a cyber attack? Think about both the meeting room that you're in, how you responded to that, etc. And what's really interesting with VR in education, it's really strong in softer skills, not just the sort of harder skills. So things like negotiation, things like working with difficult situations. You can practice over and over again in a VR world, see what those responses are, and probably feel a little bit less self-conscious in a VR world as opposed to working with someone directly.
And that's Stephen Anderson from PwC Middle East speaking about their new report.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
We are getting the lowdown on what the cities of the future will look like.
Smart City Theatre si pitti helare. Metro marka mandavara patti galare. Oi, Smart City Theatre si pitti helare.
Something I picked up in Mumbai over the weekend, a song about smart cities. And joining us in the studio is one of the world's foremost authorities on smart cities. I'm going to have to take a deep breath to describe his job titles. He is Senior Advisor on Future Cities and New Industries at HSBC Bank, Global Fellow at the Brookings Institution, author of the book Global Cities, A Short History. And that's not even his day job, which is a Professor of Urban Innovation at UCL, University College London, Greg Clark. Thanks for joining us. You're a regular visitor to the UAE, I know that. This week in particular, you're going to be at the Abu Dhabi Sustainability Week. What are you going to be telling people that they haven't already heard about smart cities?
Well, it's very interesting to be here at Abu Dhabi Sustainability Week because it's a big gathering, as you know, and this is a year when this region is gathering all sorts of people. The World Urban Forum is coming, of course the G20 is coming, and as we know, the 2020 Expo is coming. So I see this as the beginning of a year-long conversation, Richard, about the future. And in particular, when we think about this region, we can look at 25, 30 cities across the region, all growing very rapidly in terms of population still, all trying to make adjustments to more efficient systems of energy, transport, real estate, all of them with diversifying economies. And what I'll be talking about to them is how do you put all of that together so that you have a successful transition which provides business opportunities, better cities, and of course, intelligent finance.
There's a lot of hype and hot air spoken about smart cities,
yeah.
Smart everything for that matter. Mm. Convince us that some of these technologies or ways of doing things can actually make cities like Dubai, Abu Dhabi, Sharjah and others greener and more efficient in tangible, measurable ways.
Yes, well, I think the fundamental way to look at this is that urban growth is a reality. It's not a choice. The choice we face is whether that urban growth is done intelligently or unintelligently. That requires not just software, but also hardware. So investment in transport systems, good land uses, investment in flood systems, water, waste, other systems is absolutely critical if you're going to manage urban growth. And then using technology to make sure those systems work in an optimal way, are responsive to customers, are priced fairly, are environmentally efficient, is absolutely critical. The hardware without the software doesn't work, but the software on its own is not so useful.
So give us some examples of things that might work, or not might work, that do work when it comes to the energy we consume or transportation, one area that you mentioned.
Yes, well, every city is a big concentration of people seeking to make journeys every day of their life, whether it's the journey from home to work or the journey from home to school or the journey from one family member to another. And if you allow those journeys just to be subject to all sorts of individual choices, you end up with congestion, you end up with pollution, you end up with frustration, right? Whereas if you make a gradual shift towards high capacity public transport systems, and if you augment those high capacity public transport systems with what we now call micro mobility, the scooters, the cycling, the walking, the other ways of traveling, and you allow the private car to be part of a bigger system, if you use your smart systems to make the ticketing easy to do, the information systems easy to understand, you make the journeys more predictable, and you make the change of modes more seamless, those technologies really make a difference to people's choices. They enable them to escape the congestion and the sprawl and instead to have a better journey time.
So what, I mean, looking around the UAE and Abu Dhabi and in Dubai, what are the three things that we could do that would make our main cities smarter?
Well, if we stay on the transport theme for a minute, Brandy, there's already at least $200 billion of major investment going into expanded metros. The faster we can complete those metro systems so that they really take people on meaningful journeys from one place to another and they start to integrate so that they can serve you for longer portions of the journey, the better. That will be the key thing, because unlocking a better journey experience and a better transport infrastructure enables you to change your land uses, enables you to have better density, enables you to change your energy systems as well.
You're also an expert on expos. You've written extensively on these events, and a lot of the work that you're doing in the UAE focuses on sustainability at Expo 2020 Dubai. Mm. And tell us what you've learned looking at Expo 2020 Dubai in terms of sustainability. We know we've got a shiny sustainability pavilion and it all looks very nice, but in terms when you scratch below the surface, what are you seeing of real substance?
Yes, well, HSBC, of course, very committed to this agenda, and HSBC is the founding sponsor of the UK's pavilion at the Expo, and really looking forward to what's going to be learnt there. I think it's absolutely right for Dubai to have put this firmly on the agenda. And if you think about where this city and this emirate is in terms of its journey from being, you know, a pearling and fishing village through its journey of being a trading hub, a tourism centre, a centre for businesses, and on the way to being a centre for innovation, for entrepreneurship, new kinds of industries, then sustainability is also about the nature of the economy that you have and the systems that support it. And what I think you'll see at Expo 2020 is the introduction to the world of a series of new technology solutions which will create many business opportunities in the area of energy, the area of food, the area of water, the area of mobility, and also the area of real estate. These are tangible business opportunities. And Expo is a great vehicle for not just showcasing these innovations and allowing more people to invest in them, but it's also a vehicle for accelerating the development of an innovative cluster here.
Greg, we're out of time now. We'll have to leave it there, but I know you're a regular visitor to the UAE, in particular in the build-up to Expo, so we will have you back in the studio. But for now, Greg Clark, Senior Advisor on Future Cities and New Industries at HSBC. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast. The Business Breakfast's pick of the papers.
Right, rustling through the papers.
This is about the business of sports and how sports people earn their money. I'll give you the details in a second. But first of all, this is the person in question, Roger Federer, arguably the greatest tennis player of all time, winning his 100th tournament here in Dubai last year.
History continues to be made by Roger Federer. Arms aloft, title number 100. His eighth here, and he did it all in 69 minutes.
That's Roger Federer winning in Dubai last year, the Dubai Duty Free Tennis Championships. They start again in about 4 weeks' time. But he's in the news not for his tennis at the moment, but because of his money. Here's the headline. Roger Federer issues a statement after the activist Greta Thunberg takes a swipe at the Swiss tennis star. This, just to remind you, is Greta Thunberg.
People are suffering. People are dying. Entire ecosystems are collapsing. We are in the beginning of a mass extinction, and all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth. How dare you?
Greta's famous speech at the United Nations last year. And the reason that Roger Federer is in hot water is over his sponsorship by Credit Suisse, the big Swiss bank. Now, a dozen Swiss activists have been appearing in court over the past few days. They refused to pay a fine for playing tennis inside branches of Credit Suisse. It was a stunt intended to underscore a couple of things. One, Roger Federer's close relationship with Credit Suisse and the large amount of money he gets paid as a brand ambassador for Credit Suisse. And also Credit Suisse's close links to the fossil fuel industry. They claim that Credit Suisse has given the fossil fuel industry $57 billion in loans and various other help since 2016, so over the past 5 years, and they are not happy that Roger Federer is profiting from that. They say Credit Suisse is destroying the planet. Roger, do you support them? And there is a hashtag, Roger Wake Up Now, which is trending on Twitter. Greta Thunberg is among hundreds of accounts to have retweeted the hashtag Roger Wake Up Now post. So he is getting some grief from her. And he's issued a statement. Did you see the statement?
I have not seen the statement. Tell me the statement.
Well, he kind of addresses the issue, but he doesn't say, and I am now ending my association with Credit Suisse. This is what he says. I take the impacts and threat of climate change very seriously, particularly as my family and I arrive in Australia amidst devastation from bushfires, he says. As a father of four young children and a fervent supporter of universal education, I have a great deal of respect and admiration for the youth climate movement. And I am grateful to young climate activists for pushing us all to examine our behaviours and act on innovative solutions. We owe it to them and ourselves to listen. But listening is the only action that he is committing to. He has not said, I am therefore reviewing all my sponsorships to make sure
that's a That's a non-statement. Look, I can kind of see both sides of this, and I can see if you were not to take any money as a sports person from any company who in any way had, you know, from a bank's point of view, had any dealings with the fossil fuel industry, from a sportswear point of view, anyone who'd ever been tainted with sort of sweatshop claim. I mean, and I'm not saying these things are right, but I'm just saying your pool of sponsors shrinks quite incredibly. However, in particularly in a time of Googleability and sort of the transparency that comes with social media and the rest, and the fact that voices like Greta's can be very easily amplified, I think it is something that sports people and the rest are going to have to think about very, very firmly. I mean, we've seen more and more, I think, than ever before, you have artists coming under fire for where they choose to perform. I mean, I don't know about you, but I have turned down the odd freelance gig where I've looked at who's offering it to me and thought, I don't think I necessarily want to be a voice for your organisation.
That's interesting. So that was a conscience thing.
It was, do you know what? It's not, it's part conscience, but also it's self-interest. I mean, let's be honest, you don't want in 10 or 15 years' time, your, I mean, voice in our case, because that's what we do, we are voices on sticks, your voice to be necessarily associated with a company that you think, yeah, I don't want to be tied to you long term. And these things, particularly, again, social media, the internet, don't go away.
It's true, isn't it? Yeah. It takes decades to build a reputation and a day to ruin one.
Exactly. So I do think that sports people, artists, all the rest of it, the Mariah Careys of the world need to think about it.
Well, certainly Credit Suisse has taken notice of it. The bank itself has issued a statement saying it is now seeking to align its loan portfolio with the objectives of the Paris Agreement. That's the big climate deal, and has recently announced in the context of its global climate strategy that it will no longer invest in new coal-fired power plants. So it is having an impact.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
The DIFC has introduced a new property leasing law, and we're asking what it means for its landlords and tenants. Very pleased to be joined in the studio by the lawyer Shahram Safai. He's a partner at Afridi and Angle Legal Consultants. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
Why did the DIFC need a new property law in the first place? Where did they need clarity?
There were two primary purposes. One, the Dubai law itself, which didn't include DIFC, was quite comprehensive. And so I think DIFC wanted to align its practices with the Dubai practices onshore. And so that's part of the reason. The second reason was that if you look at the old law, which was passed in the early 2000s, it was only about 4 pages. And it really had talked about what the DIFC registrar could do as opposed to what the parties could do. So it was very laissez-faire, and parties could do, you know, as much as they wanted, etc. And now I think this law, which is about 20 pages, much more detailed, gives further protections to tenants and landlords.
And a lot of people will be thinking DIFC, they'll be thinking banks, they might be thinking posh tailors. But am I right in thinking this is primarily residential?
It's true, exactly. I think the changes are primarily geared towards residential tenancies. Of course, there are general changes that have been done that protect for all leases. For example, that all leases must be in writing, they must have a term, they should specify the premises, etc. But really, most of the protections, is a good word, are geared towards residential tenancies.
Well, let's look in depth at a couple of areas that are making headlines. One is the deposit scheme that they have introduced here. Tell me about that.
Yeah, very interesting. And the deposit scheme is there to protect tenants. It says that you can charge a deposit. That deposit must be a maximum of 10% of the rent. So they've capped that security deposit. The other major change is that security deposit must be paid into an escrow account, which is administered by the DIFC, by the registrar. And so that's protective of the tenant for sure, and also for the landlord. It takes that issue out of the hands of the landlord.
And those deposits have also been capped?
Yes, at 10% of the total rent for the year.
What about termination? We've got some clearer rules, haven't we, around terminating leases?
Correct. So terminations, you're free to agree how to terminate pursuant to terms of the lease. But now terminations can occur explicitly, as in the law, if, for example, a tenant doesn't pay the rent within 30 days, that application can be made to court and termination. Or if the tenant breaches a term of the lease, vice versa. Also with the landlord, if the landlord breaches a term of the lease, then terminations can be applied for. The court now, the DIFC court, has been brought into the centre where disputes can be referred there and expressly referred to in the new leasing law.
How much of an advantage is that for people who are renting property in the DIFC? The ability to be able to use not just the framework, but that court?
Well, it adds stability and predictability. And I think the focus of this law primarily is to introduce more transparency and predictability to how tenancies work. That in turn means that people will be more comfortable renting in the DIFC. And so as we look towards Expo 2020 and all these wonderful changes that have been made, then you'll see DIFC tenancies flourishing. And so it is important to give further predictability and further transparency on paper to tenants and landlords, and then translate that to say, well, that transparency will be given to you by the courts and they're accessible to you. So that's really the message that's coming across.
It would have to be something quite big, surely, though, to take your landlord to court. I mean, you're not going to drag them into court because they haven't fixed your blinds.
Of course. I mean, we're talking about the, 5% of cases. And 95%, people are reasonable. And so landlords and tenants will get along. They'll sign a condition report at the beginning of the tenancy, maybe take some photographs showing the condition of the apartment. And then upon, ending of the lease, then they'll compare and set something off and agree together. And that should really be 95% of the cases, as it is in most developed jurisdictions. But of course, it's the 5% where there may be a dispute.
How much flexibility does this still leave parties within agreements? I mean, I've just moved, and because the market at the moment, the rentee, the tenant, is holding a lot more cards than maybe they were 4 or 5 years ago. There was negotiation about notice periods. There was negotiation about how much rent I would forfeit if I broke the lease early. And there's a lot more to-ing and fro-ing, I think, than there was a while ago. Can you still do that with these rules?
Yes, you can. I think this provides you with a minimum framework, but it's still more than used to exist in DIFC. And so I see this along the same theme as what you're saying, as protective of the tenant by capping security deposits, by talking about termination and things of that nature. So the flexibility continues. Of course, the market always determines the power of landlords and or tenants.
Is there anything in this law that we could possibly see migrated to the onshore market? I mean, we've been talking already this morning about the new pension scheme that's starting up in DIFC, and Nadia, the recruitment agency we've just had in their report, that potentially they think it could go to other free zones and then to onshore to become the norm. Could we see things like deposits going into an escrow account, for example, which we already obviously see in the property sales market? Could we see that for rental possibly going wider in Dubai?
Well, I'm sure. Interestingly, I was thinking about exactly the same thing this morning. I think exactly the Dubai Land Department will be looking at that scheme and thinking that that is of interest, because it gives more assurance to the landlords and tenants, and also reduces disputes to a great extent.
No more niggling to get your deposit back at the end of your tenancy.
Exactly. As you know, as you may know, onshore, there have been some instances where landlords have kept security deposits, or so tenants allege. And so this does away with that issue.
Interesting stuff. Shakram Safi, who is a partner at Afridian Engel Legal Consultants, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks very much indeed for listening. We're back tomorrow morning live, 6 a.m. with the Business Breakfast Breakfast.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.